One of the things that I have lived, and I know a lot of our brothers and sisters in public safety live, is that imposter syndrome. I needed to be on the pinnacle, the precipice of something better, something bigger. You know, that fight or flight, you know, the combat, the being attacked with a knife or being shot at. The thing that improv really allows us to do is do a deeper dive. When you as a supervisor says, yes, I hear what you're saying, and I hear you, I agree with you, I see you, I validate you, improv kind of allows us to do the same thing. And it's the new mindfulness, if you listen to people and psychologists. We're using acceptance, even if we don't agree, standard.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience, along with my co-host, Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW EMT. I'm David Dashinger. On this episode, we'll be speaking with Eric Chase of EMS Improv, LLC, and podcast about using improv to stay present, improve concentration, and sharpen focus, and for daily living and doing the first responder job. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook under Responder Wellness, Inc. and Responder TV. Also on bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the podcast platforms. And we're on respondertv.com for all the past episodes. We'll be right back to speak with Eric after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Responder Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rumeli, LCSW EMTB. Today we're joined by Eric Chase. He's got a widely varied background in military, law enforcement, firefighting, and EMS as a paramedic. Eric's also a speaker, educator, and podcaster, and dedicated to improving individual and organizational engagement in a pro-social, psychologically safe environment. Eric provides workshops and classes, including dealing with failure, listening, feedback, simulations, public speaking, accepting ideas, collaboration, leadership, mindfulness, anxiety, and resilience, and it emphasizes the role of play and joy through humor. So we're going to have a lot to talk about today. Welcome, Eric, to Respond to Resilience.
David, thank you very much. And Bonnie, I appreciate this opportunity. It's hard not to get emboldened by hearing that. It's always sounds more important hearing somebody else say that, even though I know I live it and I've experienced it. I want to say thank you.
It's nice to have you. Dare I say you're overqualified. You check all of our boxes, which is great. We can't wait to hear about it.
Well, it's interesting hearing that, checking all the boxes. One of the things that I have lived, and I know a lot of our brothers and sisters in public safety live, is that imposter syndrome. And when we're living by our badge, our uniform, our title, and not being able to remove that when we have our personal relationships, and then having it all muddled together. And for me, with all those experiences, I was having difficulties engaging with loved ones and friends in my life, to the point where my wife, my second wife, because I'm divorced, and a lot of that was because of bad behaviors, excessive alcohol, cheating, and things that I'm not proud of, but also things that I've dealt with the consequences. And I think foremost, that's the most important thing, is if we've dealt with the consequences of our actions and behaviors, they can't be used against us again by anybody else. They're going to try. But when I talk to people, I let them know that you've already lived those experiences. You've already dealt with the consequences, and it's really time to move forward. When I was dealing with survivor guilt and working with my wife. She actually told me, she said, you need to find your joy. I was living a life that was not congruent with being happy either at work or at home, because I was so focused on taking care of the mission, the patient, the duty, whatever was going on, that I could not isolate myself and be an individual. So when I hear that, and that's why I kind of felt really emotional when you were saying all the things that I've done. Yes, I've done those. And to what cost? Because how was I truly present? Was I truly engaged at the time that I was doing those things? And to what benefit was I the best human being interacting with those that I was dealing with?
Well, I think that's a great point. And by checking the boxes, I was thinking about all the branches that you worked in. And just hearing the fallout of that, I think, is really important for our guests, you know, to understand that, yes, there is a cost. And I think most people in our professions, whether they do one branch or all, in your case, they can see the impact in their life. And I can only imagine or surmise that that impact is even further when you're involved in more than one. And I think David and I have known some of those people locally. And you do see the toll. So we're very grateful to have you here sharing your story. Thanks for being so honest. And we can't wait to hear some of the great strategies that you've really stumbled upon and that you're bringing to the world. So can you talk a little bit about your background and how it came to pass that you were involved in all of the branches that you were, law enforcement, military, fire, and EMS?
Absolutely. I attended Mercyhurst University, which was at the time college up in Erie, Pennsylvania. And I had a degree, or I got my bachelor's degree in criminal justice. And I thought at that point in time, I was a 21-year-old college graduate, very immature, didn't really know a direction or a purpose for my life. I was more interested in sports and athletics that I was doing as a soccer player, and I rode crew in college. So I really wasn't focusing on my life. So I thought, okay, what better to do as a college graduate, but then to enlist in the Army? And that was an absolutely idiotic thing to have done. But apparently I still learned a lot of great things through those experiences. Both my parents were Air Force officers, and they were perplexed and befuddled to the point where, you know, you can only ask why so many times, and your kids are still going to do what they're going to do in many cases. So I was that example of, I know what your history was, and I'm going to still trudgingly along my own path for better or for worse. So with that, I kind of did I was a reservist, but not paying attention to politics and world kind of issues. That was during Desert Shield and Desert Storm as it was ramping up. So I didn't expect or anticipate the fact that there would be war by being in the military. Again, very immature person at 21. With the degree, nevertheless, I wasn't looking at things globally. I wasn't looking at things on the macro scale. I was very isolated and very within my own silo of being. I was more interested in getting married and moving away and, you know, planting my own flag. And to me, really, in retrospect, I was running away from social engagements, you know, even my own family, for whatever dysfunction that we had. My father was an alcoholic. My parents were divorced. They did their best with four sons, but I felt I could do better on my own. And I moved to North Carolina. I got married subsequently to that with my college sweetheart. So between deployments or active duty, I never was in combat, so I was not a combat veteran. But there was always those thoughts of ramping up and going. So for a lot of veterans that I work with and talk to, they have that feeling of guilt or shame for they've trained, but they never got to do the job that they trained for. And you know, you talk to veterans that have been in combat, and I've had plenty on my podcast, that they said, I would wish for nobody to experience what I've experienced. Mm-hmm. So there's a confluence of two different perspectives, still with the same feelings, guilt and shame and emotion. I wanted to do it because I trained for it, and I did it and I didn't want to experience it after the fact what I experienced. So you see people coming from all these different perspectives with the same emotional responses, which started me thinking, well, if we're all feeling the same way, are we all broken? Or is there a common key to the situation? And I didn't know at the time what it was.
When you retire, you're just another employee that's gone. In 10 years, you'll be, oh yeah, that's good old what's his name.
And sometimes I think for a lot of us, it's scary to retire when you've been raised by an organization for almost three decades.
There's a running joke that says that as you retire, you're forgotten about before you even leave the parking lot.
It wasn't that I was losing the passion for the job. I decided I want to go ahead and transition and start traveling and talking to groups of people.
I lost who I was. I didn't have any plans for the future. I sunk.
And we're always saving for a rainy day. And what ends up happening is you die and you never receive the benefit of you working so hard for so long.
It's as if you've lost a loved one. For me, there's a sadness there.
They really do become your second family.
I was a firefighter. That was always what I wanted to do. Sometimes life throws you a curveball and you find yourself without an identity.
I would pass police cars and it was like somebody punched me in the stomach. Like I got sick because I missed it so bad.
When you say I'm a retired firefighter, people, they notice. And they're like, wow, man, that's incredible. And it provides an avenue for you to be impactful.
I thought because I have a military background, I had a criminal justice degree, that I was going to go into law enforcement. And I had worked for the Department of Justice. I'm not going to say the agency, but I was a law enforcement training center, firearms instructor, self-defense, disturbance control instructor. So I did a lot of high-speed things. I was on a tactical team. I went into hostage situations. We deployed for riots and social uprisings as well. And I saw a lot of things and participated in things and was shot at or attacked and used force in a civilian role that I didn't have to do in the military role. So everything kind of cascaded into those experiences where then I was having regret or guilt over some of the things that I had done. And now we're talking about moral injury today, which we weren't even considering 25, 30 years ago. Things that you experienced and weren't able to have a good outcome or successful or positive outcome as a result of. So I started living in a real darkness. Every time I would get deployed with a team, I drank, and it wasn't an excuse. I had affairs, and they weren't longstanding relationships. And the alcohol was not the cause of me cheating. It was my desire to get more. It wasn't necessarily anxiety. It wasn't necessarily depression, but I needed to be on the pinnacle, the precipice of something better, something bigger. Sexual arousal goes along with, that fight or flight, the combat, the being attacked with a knife or being shot at, your emotions are just going up. So subsequent to my behavior, my wife at the time, she chose to divorce me, which I think was a really smart idea for her. But it did cause me, and my actions caused a broken family, to which I don't even have a really good relationship with my son from that marriage. So I wasn't being a very good human being. And yet I was being really adept at what my skills, the leadership responsibilities, and my team engagement were calling me to do. But it was completely devoid of really good relational experiences with my brothers, my mother, my father, or any of my family. I was truly a gypsy. And I would move for the best opportunity for the next position or the highest, career ranking that I could get. And it just continued to be a life of brokenness. So in 2003, in December, I decided to resign or retire from the Justice Department. I said it was for medical reasons. I knew that I had a lot of things going on, but I didn't know that they were mental, and I didn't know that they were strictly physical. And they were certainly again both. But ultimately, I was falling out, passing out, having issues with my heart that we didn't know until December of 2002, when I had my first heart attack, that I had a lot of heart issues. Some of them were originally, because of genetics. Others of it, which may have been the chemicals I was exposed to, and or other stressors, just so many different things. With that being said, I didn't do anything for about a year and a half. I decided to have ankle surgery. It was fused. I started teaching at a local school. And you think, why was I teaching? Well, I got my post-secondary teaching certificate, and I was an adjunct faculty in criminal justice at two community colleges in Colorado during this time. And I found that I loved engaging with students that were causing me to open my eyes to learning experiences as much as sharing with them experiential knowledge and learning. And knowledge, I was starting to realize, by itself without skill doesn't really help us. Rote memorization of things is not really superbly or profoundly beneficial. It checks a box, but it doesn't extrapolate itself to the fact, can this person do what you need them to do with that knowledge? So I already started seeing a pattern where I needed to be more engaged, physically engaged, and sharing these things with my students, whether they be through workshops or scenario-based or what have you. So I was doing that. I started teaching at a behavioral school for kids. And at the same time, every day, twice a day, I would pass a fire station. As I was passing the fire station, I thought, that sounds cool. Well, my grandmother died in that time frame. We all got about, several thousand dollars from her estate. I decided to go to EMT school in Colorado. I went to EMT school, stopped by the fire station, and asked if they were hiring for the ambulance. They said, they kind of laughed at me. They said, well, we're having an academy. If you want to apply, in 3 or 4 months, get in shape, do this. And, you can take the test and all that kind of stuff. So I ended up getting on the fire department, and that's where that career path, they sent me to paramedic school, kind of sent me out of the law enforcement spectrum, out of the military spectrum, but also still a very paramilitary, very structured organization that really benefited me from the standpoint of mission, methods, accountability, and that's a big thing too, is being accountable, being held accountable by yourself or by your superiors. So that's how I got into EMS and firefighting. My heart problems, they resulted in 3 different heart attacks. I have a pacemaker because of sick sinus syndrome. About a month and a half ago, I just had my second or my newest pacemaker put in. And I'm working on that. But I know that I gave you a lot of things right there. That still doesn't tell us where we're going or how I got to today. But it kind of paints a picture for a lot of issues that I had to work through. And to how I can be so positive now and be uncomfortably comfortable sharing them with the thousands of people that are going to see this, with the hopes that it's going to benefit 1, 2, or 100 of them. Because I just want them to know, and I'm looking in the screen, you are not alone, and we care about you.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of that, Eric. And it's all, I think, very relevant to our conversation today and sets up sort of foundation for where we're going to go from here. And I'm sure that because of your varied background, you've touched many people who are in all those different disciplines. There's a mission of service and compassion and love to be that vulnerable and that open and honest to share like that. So we appreciate that.
Well, I appreciate hearing that. As you were saying that, I was thinking about the people that know me but don't know that story. Mm-hmm. And I just hope, if it affects how they look at me tomorrow, or if it keeps me from having an opportunity to do a training with them, I would just ask them to reflect upon that. And there's a word that I have that I use now is grace. Mm-hmm. And when you have grace for yourself and when you have grace for others, I think it puts us in a spirit of of being able to really truly understand and accept others, even if we don't agree with what they've done or what they've been through.
I unloaded 32 years of emotion.
This job isn't a joke, and it can hurt you.
How does yoga or meditation help with that?
Coming to terms with who you are.
You know, nobody calls us because they're having a good day.
It's really the suicide that becomes a huge issue.
People are more trustworthy with the dog.
Sleep deprivation helps them either be better or worse.
Completely secretive when we started this.
So it's pretty much taboo.
Take care of the people next to you.
First responders really being open about what they're struggling with.
If we know that, let's raise awareness.
Brings you together to talk about it, and it tells you you're not alone.
Let's segue from there into the EMS improv piece. Now, you and I had a conversation 2 or 3 weeks ago, and we started talking about the similarities between a bunch of musicians getting on stage and jamming and showing up, let's say, to a fire scene where there's, you know, an incident going on. Let's call it a structure fire. And how there are all these parallels, right? Like musicians on a stage, okay, they don't just all get up there and play random notes. There's like a set of, you know, they're going to, let's play Mustang Sally. And there's, you know, a set of chords. There's a form to the song. It's kind of like protocols or policies and procedures. But to a certain extent, they may or may not have worked together before. They're to some extent improvising and riffing, and, you know, they find a way to work together and make music out of it. In the same way, we all sometimes show up to a scene and there's mutual aid and there's different agencies, and somehow we mitigate the emergency. So can you talk to the improvisation piece of emergency services? Like, how do you see improvisation as part of what we do as first responders?
So, David, exactly like you said, and we all do, and when people can recognize that we all have to improvise on a day-to-day basis, even if we don't understand the tenets cognitively for what the tools and the exercises will do for us, we recognize that we do improvise. So a lot of people think that, well, I don't need any more training on that because I understand the fact that I am improvising, that we are mitigating the problem or the emergency because we are coming together under the auspices of our SOPs or SOGs or our protocols. The thing that improv really allows us to do is do a deeper dive. And we talked about knowledge and skill a while back. The knowledge is what we have, is the first checkbox to graduate from the academy. We passed a test. We passed a protocol test. Then we're put into a training modality where we're observed and monitored and we're held accountable for our actions and behaviors. And we're very strictly operating within guidelines and SOPs and SOGs and protocols. The improvisational piece is the skill piece where we start adapting the knowledge to whatever we have to do. And how do I put this? If improv allows or creates an atmosphere of trust, a psychologically pro-social environment where you will always say, if you're my lieutenant, David, and you tell me something to do, and I have a question, and you immediately want to say no, what does no do to us psychologically? And how many times have we heard no over time? No hurts us. No puts us in a deep psychological funk, and it may refer us back to an injury or trauma years and years ago because you were told, be quiet, don't tell anybody. You have to be, so no, you don't want to speak about this. Don't talk to people. So that takes us back to hurt, guilt, pain, and shame. When you as a supervisor says, yes, I hear what you're saying, and I hear you, I agree with you, I see you, I validate you, are all the different ways that we talk about what improv does in the safe, psychological, pro-social environment. We're using an acceptance, even if we don't agree, standard. And if you don't practice that, just like with protocols, policies, and procedures, you're not going to be able to do it successfully well. So it's the confluence of knowledge and skill and working together. Some people say, well, is that kind of simulation training? Yes, you can do it in simulation training, but you also have to open yourselves up to the ideas that other people are going to bring a new perspective and be okay with that. Rote memorization and structure are safe places. but they also do not allow the person to be their most authentic self. And prior to coming on the podcast, we did a mindfulness, a being present kind of situation where you kind of led us in some breathing techniques and we came to a sense of oneness between our mind, body, and spirit. Improv kind of allows us to do the same thing. And it's the new mindfulness. If you listen to people and psychologists and people, by being present, by listening better, by giving and receiving feedback in that safe environment, you can be on that fire ground. You could be on a medical call and not just being so perturbed or upset or angry that you're yelling at somebody and basically telling them, no, that's not what you're supposed to do. And barring it being a true life or death situation where a no is appropriate or stop that behavior, there are so many different ways that we can say no without ever saying no, where it does not harm somebody's psychological being. There are people out there that are going to hear this and think, this doesn't make sense to me because I've come from a background of leadership where I was told you see a behavior, you hold them accountable. But then after that, what? Where's the growth aspect? Because we don't teach a lot of leaders to do the follow-up, the follow-through. They don't have the HR experience. They don't have the psychological training and background. But, you know, everybody doesn't have to be an LCSW, right? They don't all have to be counselors. That's why peer support training is so important now, because we're starting to recognize that people are willing to share and be okay with feelings if somebody that has done what they have done are also sharing those things. So we do games, we do exercises, we use the role of play and humor to create an environment that opens up that left prefrontal cortex, our amygdala, our hippocampus, the limbic system, emotions, cognitive learning, where once those are opened up, we see a richer gain. Going back to what you were talking about, David, and those musicians that get up on the stage and they've never played together, but they understand chords, they understand notes. And when a chord is started, the bass can come in and start laying down a track, right? The piano can come in and start just tearing up the keys. The guitar will overlay that, right? But it's all within the same understanding of chords and music. What does that do on an MRI? That lights it up. You see that limbic system, that left prefrontal cortex light up. And we know now with neuroplasticity, when you talk about the amygdala, the hippocampus, when our brains, and we know through stem cells that come from those regions in the brain, you may have damage, you may have hurt, you may have pain, post-traumatic stress, moral injury. You can recover in many cases from those, unless it's truly physical damage to those parts of the brain. But we also know that the brain now has other inner pathways, similar to what the heart does, right? So a role of play, excitement, energy, exercises to stimulate that cognitive and emotional centers help us to see and be more mindful, to be more present. And EMS stands for to engage. We're all engaged right now. This is the social aspect. We can be connected because of our prior work or our desires, but we want to emphasize the social piece, which is the engagement from my perspective, and is being mindful. If I'm mindful of the fact that you have a different background and Bonnie, you have a different background than me, I'm going to be receptive to that right from the very beginning. And I'm bringing myself in a state of yes and to what you share with me, whether I agree with it or not, I'm willing to listen and hear. That is growth mindset. That's an interoperability, if we want to talk about a public safety term.
Right.
And then the S is the stories. And we share or tell our stories and gain an opportunity to be more relational again with those people around us. And that's the healthy benefit, the benefit of resilience. You can be redeemed after you've gone through the consequences of your actions. This training gives us an opportunity to laugh, to cry, to be our most authentic selves, to let those facades, those walls of our experiences, the badge that I wore, the uniform that I wore, I don't identify as that anymore. And I come as my authentic self, Eric Chase, in a spirit of compassion with empathy. And to that point, when you listen to people doing our improv tools and techniques, when you're present, when you receive and give feedback thoughtfully, that is using the essential skills, the affective skills, and that's empathetic. And people think that you can't be that or you shouldn't, because we have the ability to be hurt by other people. We know that, right? It doesn't say take away wisdom, and it doesn't say take away discernment. It just says create an opportunity in a space that is safe for them. And if it's safe for them, it's going to be safe for you to have an open conversation. The discernment piece says, you know what, I can't do any more for you, but I know a resource like Bonnie that we can refer you to, and they can take it from here. Mm-hmm. So it's a building process as well.
Well, I really like the fact that you're pointing out the amygdala and what's happening there. And just for some of our viewers that need a little refresher, shall we say, the amygdala is where your fight or freezes. And so what we see a lot with first responders is that they're stuck in one of these modes. And because their window of tolerance is constantly going above their window of tolerance. I like the fact that you're pointing out the scientific facts that improv improves the neuroplasticity and calms the amygdala down, which is exactly the kind of effects that we look at with EMDR as well. Obviously a different process and different meanings and different ways, but I think it's great that there's science behind this as well.
When it comes to occupational cancer exposures, members of the fire service are some of the highest risk professionals nationwide. Firefighters Against Cancer and Exposures, also known as the FACES Foundation, is an advocacy organization established to bring awareness, resources, and peer support to responders in need of additional help in battling potential cancer diagnoses or critical concerns. The FACES Foundation was established by a national alliance of first responders to offer supplemental resources for firefighters. One of its core initiatives is cancer awareness in the form of prevention and early detection, supporting vigilance about occupational cancers and cancer recurrence through our national Get Checked Now campaign. Also, the FACES Foundation publishes a major public catalog of resources for the many areas of need, including information on clinical and mental health therapies, benefits and compensations, funding sources and financial strategies. For more information, please visit the FACES website at facesusa.org.
Bonnie, amazingly enough, and to that point, my body, you know, came a little bit more alive hearing that. When people are in our trainings and going through the experience, and I know what they've done as a firefighter, as a chief officer, as a veteran, as a law enforcement officer, and some of the horrors that they've seen, or some of the heroic actions that they've had to take, a lot of them don't want to engage. They don't want to participate. They're coming to this training is a knowledge-based training, right? Because that's what we've been conditioned to do for so often. You know, I'm going to go for a CEU. I need that knowledge. But we don't look at it enough as it's a skill set that we also can put them together. So I won't dime out the department, but I was in Florida for a training seminar last year, and I'm going back again this year. But I had several paramedics that I passed out cards at the beginning. They had to answer some questions. And we just wanted to create an engagement opportunity, a little bit of vulnerability. They weren't sharing their life secrets or anything like that. They were just reading a card and then answering a question. Well, I knew that I had put out 12 cards, and there was about 30 people out there. And my wife was in the back of the group, and that was the first presentation she ever came to. And she kind of pointed to them because they said, well, I don't have all the cards. Well, these guys had hid them and put them aside on the table because they didn't want to engage with us. I politely called them out and I just said, hey guys, you don't have to do any of these things. And we give them a free space to participate. And I think that's important as well. But it's such a low stakes environment to still engage these things that when we're in a high stakes environment, like a fire, a shooting, an assault, dealing with a patient that's in a life or death situation, or even not a life or death situation, but to them, it's the first emergency that they've ever had. So how can we be there for them most effectively? And it's learning these skills with the knowledge that we have to assimilate that to a relational perspective versus just transactional. And that's what the improv exercises also do. You may feel that flight, flight, or freeze kind of reaction, when you get put up on stage, and we're not doing any of these things on stage, when you get up in front of your peers, and we've had paramedics and doctors and chief officers and law enforcement officers and veterans and every title and position that you could have, and nurses as well. So when they get up there around each other, they're comfortable in their own setting. And we want to let them know that they can do and be excited and be proud of themselves in any setting, because they stand on a foundation of knowledge. And we're giving them a tool to show how to express that differently and be more open to other people sharing as well.
If I can share my experience and help just one person, or help one person help somebody else, that's what it's all about.
We're trying to break down the stigma. We're trying to share that there are great, effective resources out there.
Vulnerability is a strength. It's not a weakness.
What I've heard from all of the subjects in my film is that I think my story can help someone else.
And as police officers, we always want to go in, see problem, fix problem. And you can't do that with a mental health crisis. You have to see person and connect with person.
This sucks, but I'm going to have to embrace this suck. You know, I don't like these cards, but these are the cards that I've been dealt, and I'm going to have to play them to the best of my ability. And I've been trying to do that for the last 10 years.
Eric, so many questions I have, and I'm going to pick one out of all of those to steer you towards. And that's, let me preface it by saying that one of the things I love the most about the fire department and the job was the brilliance of the people I worked with. And I'll also say EMS, because we were all cross-trained as EMTs and paramedics, and we were running EMS calls alongside fire calls. But the guys I worked with blew me away shift after shift with their amazing creativity and brilliance in solving problems and coming up with solutions to situations, whether it was how to move a patient or how to deal with a bandaging with what we had on scene or a logistical problem, you name it. So how does improv and what you do facilitate the creative problem solving processes for first responders?
Well, thank you for saying that, or even asking that question. I immediately went to like a Chicago Fire TV show where it's always the officer, like the lieutenant on the truck or the rescue, doing these things and not delegating responsibilities, right? And actually, in real life, it's generally 99% flip-flopped, right? Because we're not looking for the hero moment or the hero role. We understand in good agencies and good training that it's a collaborative role. What the improv does in our exercises and our trainings when we go to departments, we'll share and show them that, again, at a very low stakes, because there's nobody going to be hurt or injured or killed if we don't do something right. We give people the opportunity to be a leader, even if they're not a leader on the fire ground or on the ambulance by title. So the chief officer, the lead paramedic, the FTO, doesn't always have to be the one that has the answer. So this gets people in the practice of saying, I feel this, or I say this, and then they add an and to that. So it's an additive piece or component where then it becomes a collaboration. So it shows us, and I think that gets to the point, hopefully addressing your question specifically, it teaches how collaboration can benefit each person and how where when you start using improv tools, there's a resilience piece as well. Because when our creative minds, when we're allowed to be creative and we're allowed to share our perspectives, we know that we're more fulfilled as a human being. So we're less likely to be put in a position of darkness or anxiety or guilt or pain, because we're training our mind and we're putting ourselves in a better position to be more resilient. We as first responders and as human beings, as you both know, we're looking for the dangers. We're ready to react and respond to the dangers, as opposed to seeing things as an opportunity to deal with the situation. And I think, and knowing that we're doing it with a team of amazing, awesome people, and I don't have to have I don't have to be the only person that has an answer, that I can rely on my team to be creative, to be collaborative, to show me a different perspective and role. And that is taught in a socially supportive environment. And all too often, the rigidity of leadership structure and training does not give you an opportunity. It's very black and white and linear. I tell you to do this, you do this, period, point and blank. And if you don't, there's a consequence, and it's an adverse consequence. We celebrate failure in improv. And I think when our bodies and our minds can learn to accept failure in a fight, flight, or freeze fun exercise, where people will get overzealous and some will become very introverted, they see and witness other people's actions, and then they start to assimilate to the positivity and the growth of the group. And we know that with positive traits or negative traits, the strongest ones are going to prevail regardless of how good the organization is. You might be on A shift in a great department at station 33, and they're a bunch of jerks. And so if you get sent there, what is the prevailing attitude? Negativity, bad behavior, and then that's what you take home, and that's what you take to your next station assignment. So we can change these things on a paradigm shift, on the flip of a coin, literally just saying yes to what you've heard, and then you offer your own piece as opposed to saying no, or as opposed to saying yes, but.
Do you think you end up seeing some of the more progressive departments and agencies because this is a little bit cutting edge and a new concept for people?
Oh, 100%. And the first fire agency that we went to, they asked us to come in. We did 2 8-hour workshops. We're right now in conversation about doing one for the entire department, every member coming. So we're obviously looking at, they're going to have to pay a lot of overtime to do this, but we're working at it through with HR, the city and the county commissioners, and the fire chief or the chief officer who's already been to one of our trainings. Because when you talk about improv and what it offers, it's an inclusivity. So diversity, equity, and inclusion training that every department and every agency across the country is going to. And we want to see people from every ethnicity, every race, gender, creed, orientation. A safe psychological environment will allow that to also be true. So we're incorporating it as a HR training, as well as the training of resiliency and how to build a resilient mindset. They had had a line of duty death at this department, and they were still reeling from it. And they shared their vulnerabilities. And we did exercises and games where there was laughter. And by the afternoon, people that weren't participating were now witnessing and participating and smiling where they weren't smiling. And we did serious conversations like that moment when this made me feel, to the point where the chief officer said, well, that made me feel sad when I went to the wife's house and to have to tell her. And then the very next officer or the next person is a rank and file firefighter and said, that made me proud. And that was the first time that the chief was vulnerable in a public setting to say and to feel that his work and his actions, somebody felt pride in that of him and for him and thanked him. And that was the healing moment, right? Mm-hmm. That was, I know Dr. Peter Antevi was on talking about closure several weeks ago. If we have all these standards and structures and guidelines and procedures, what's the other piece that we need? That loop closure. I know you do that with the EMDR. You relive experiences and you do these things. With improv, you can do them very similarly. And we had counselors and psychologists and psychiatrists there. If a person were going to have an immediate need, right? Because this was a catalyst for a significant feeling. We wanted them to have a safe landing space. We knew in them sharing their feelings alone, they felt safe in the yes and environment, the improv environment. But we know that that is one component to resiliency and mental health. And therapy and medication, if need be, are another collaborative piece. And when we see them used together, we know that there's the best opportunities for that person, that patient, that individual being the healthiest that they can be.
So Eric, I'm thinking of the movie Top Gun Maverick, where there's a thread and one of the main characters is saying, don't think, just do. In your work with improv, how does that work? Does it help people to get out of their thinking mind and get into more of a flow state, more of a creative presence, so they're not overthinking something, but actually being in this, like, in the moment, so to speak?
Interesting question. And yes, firstly, I wouldn't have understood it had I not experienced it for myself and being in a flow state. I came from a leadership background and a lot of training and fairly well educated, a lot of knowledge. And so at times I looked at people like probably inferior. And I'm saying that with just plain openness, right? It was repugnant at the time. Also, you know, just that linear train of thought, I need you to do this, so go do this. And I need you to get it done, and I'm giving you a time frame. For me, when I got on the improv stage for the very first time after witnessing people, I was in fight, flight, or freeze. And I was in the freeze state because I didn't want to engage. I was fearful of how people were going to see me. And I knew that I was up there being very vulnerable. And radical vulnerability is the key to that. Once you get up there in this very low stakes environment where nobody's house is going to burn down or explode, or you're not going to get a return of spontaneous circulation on a cardiac patient, the opportunity, and yes, for them to be very present, because you start seeing physical body mannerisms. There's eye contact, there's mirroring of attitudes and actions, mirror neurons that we all have in our minds. I always tell people, and we had a group of physicians, about 100 of them this summer, where I said, are there any neurologists in the group? And one or two sheepishly raised their hands, because again, they didn't want to, you know, have the focus on them. And I said, I tell people that we're generally Wi-Fi connected. Would that be, you know, rudimentary thinking? Would that be appropriate? And they both agreed that yes, we're generally Wi-Fi connected. It goes back again to positive or negative traits and how we collaborate in that environment. Each person that participated, including these physicians, saw themselves smiling when people were smiling, felt themselves and saw themselves frowning. So we start to assimilate the environment that we're in. And by being very engaged, by being super present, by sharing that, we definitely are seeing people get out of their logical mind and getting into a state of action and free state, or that flow state of cognition, where they're just being. So you don't have to worry about level one or level two thinking, where level one is right until it's 100% wrong, and level two is that real slow and methodical. This is just such an amazing safe space of flow that whatever happens is just amazing. And it can be very serious. It can be very funny. And 9 times out of 10, it's not even real from a standpoint of empirical knowledge. It is just people making things up and collaborating and being super creative, which creates the magic. And when people have experienced that, when you go back into in a relationship question with your spouse or at work, and you use those tenets, you just accept what's given to you. And that's how that flow comes. You're not an impediment to progress anymore. You're a cog of positivity and appropriate change.
Well, what's really neat is that it feels like we do EMS improv light. You know, when we come back from a call and we tell our stories to each other and we do our dark humor, I would venture to say there's some of this on the brain of the calming and soothing and social interaction that you're talking about. But like, is that the way you set it up is it's very structured, threatening, and people can be vulnerable. And there are some crews where people don't feel that way. You know, so I think it's special when you can feel that way with your team or your crew. I know I've had the blessing of having that feeling many times over. But I love that you're creating a structured environment for this, and an environment where brass doesn't matter. You know, everybody's on an even playing field. And I think whenever we can do that, it means so much to people and they learn so much. So thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate hearing that. And it's my absolute pleasure to be able to, one, share. And then I'm humbled in the opportunity as well, because this is something that this is a gift. It's a tool. It's a component of things that can really benefit us individually. And when you mentioned rank and things like that, when we were initially talking about this in different organizations, we want people coming in their civilian clothes. We know what wearing a uniform and rank structure means, and how oftentimes we become subservient to that rank because of the structure. We do provide a very structured course or presentation or workshop, and yet when the people start engaging, there is that freedom to be themselves. And your words were very thoughtful. And in retrospect to different people and groups that I've been around, I've had a lot of great facilitators of collaboration. And whether being a rookie firefighter or a brand new paramedic, I've had a lot of wonderful people that have shared with me the ability to express feelings and emotions immediately following, which I think is cathartic for most of us, because they've created a safe place. So this is almost an homage to them as well, for all the amazing people that have really been there for me when I didn't know what up or down was in my life. I want to thank them as well, because each one of them plays a key role to the growth of me as a human being. And I can't thank them enough. And I wouldn't even be able to reach out to every one of them to tell them that. So hopefully this will be able to do that. So the people that know me, that have been with me, that have helped me, that have been a guidepost and a light in my darkness, I want to say thank you.
So Eric, please share with us a little bit about the podcast and where people can find you out there on social media and the internet.
So the EMS Improv podcast, we always start with where we engage, where we're mindful, and we share, tell our stories. The EMS Improv podcast was started about 2.5 years ago when Jeff Frankel from the Journal of Emergency Medicine asked if I'd be interested in doing a podcast. A very good friend of mine, Stephen Cohen, who just did his last podcast, I got to host his podcast, the Medic to Medic podcast. With that being said, I had a lot of hours listening to Stephen's podcast, and Stephen and I are friends, and I asked him his input, and I thought that people have given me a platform to be vulnerable, to be honest, to share, and hopefully help someone else. So I thought, if Jeff, I can keep the name EMS Improv, and if I can have any guest on carte blanche without you approving or disapproving, then I'm going to say yes to doing the podcast. We open it up to people that want to talk about their own mental health issues and path to leadership, to administrative, training, or whatever the case may be. We're open to everything. The next podcast that we're doing is with John Moon from the Freedom House Ambulance Service in Pittsburgh in the Hill District, 55 some odd years ago. So I'm super excited about that and keeping that history alive. And that's not the only thing that we do. The EMS Improv LLC, where we bring training, the creativity, the collaboration, the safe psychological environment, is something that for each of you that are considering this or wanting to have questions answered, I think this podcast is going to do a great service. And I want to thank both of you for the questions that you've asked and the ability to share, because we don't know what we don't know. And we all have a level of hubris to a point. And sometimes we're unwilling to hear other ideas because we're doing okay. And being okay is okay fundamentally. And yet we want to be in a growth mindset if we're in leadership positions. We want to have new perspectives, and we want to push people past our level of management or leadership. And I think allowing them to grow freely gives us a really great opportunity with the training. I'm at Eric Chase on LinkedIn, at Improv Eric on Twitter, and EMS Improv on Facebook. And I appreciate the opportunity to share those as well. Thank you, David.
It's been a great conversation, Eric. It's really been enlightening for us. Thank you for what you're doing. And we hope we can cross paths again in the future.
I look forward to that. Thank you to both. And May a peace which surpasses all understanding be with both of you.
And you.
Thank you. And you. Please like and subscribe our YouTube channel, Responder Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and visit our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.